Science WTC. I'm Mo, and I'm joined, as always, by more hosts than any man can handle, Brett.
Woo!
Woo.
Bigger, better, and badder. Yes!
Yeah, there you go. There you go, Brett. You got any topics you want to hit, or do you want me to just throw it out to you?
You throw it out to me. Come on. I'm sitting here. I am waiting for you to give me something good.
That's okay. I can see you got the energy today. A little more. You got the energy today a little more than last episode where you looked like you were death on wheels. So let's
death on wheels, thanks. Well, perhaps I was ready for sleep, but that's okay.
That's okay. I'm always ready for sleep and food. Anyways, as people who've seen me know.
More bread, please.
Anyways, onto the world of comic books. Let's talk a little bit here. All right, Brett, I want to get to something we don't often cover. Brand new issues so much. We're often trying to think of some more theoretical or hypothetical and analysis of bigger events. But since we had Mike Mignola on 2 weeks ago in a great audio interview in our debut episode, this week his main character, Hellboy, killed off. And I guess it was quite a shock to the reading audience. I just want to get your thoughts on that.
Well, it was a shock to me. And you know, it's interesting. It's an interesting concept. The idea of Hellboy goes to hell. It makes sense, and it's almost surprising that we haven't seen it earlier.
Oh yeah, I actually, you know, sounds like story one.
But yeah, I think that it's funny because it's not just the fans like the reader fans that like us that have been thrown off. It's actually the creators that worked on the book as well. They've really been thrown off.
Yeah, they didn't know it was coming, and that's interesting. And it's funny because, I mean, when we interviewed Mignola, he knew what was coming.
Yeah,
he sure didn't tip his hand to us. But is it just consider we were talking some about the death of comic book characters? Is it just another? I think it's another marketing ploy, just part of a bigger storyline. It's tough to see it as it doesn't feel like a marketing ploy as the same way as Johnny Storm being killed off does.
No, I don't really believe that Mignola goes in for the big marketing ploy. I don't feel like he really needs to. And I think in the case of Hellboy, it really was part of just his strategy. Like, it was something that maybe made sense right now.
Okay. Well, let's move on to another one. What do you think about the idea of Norman Osborn versus the Avengers?
You know, I mean, they've been bringing back Norman Osborn for the better part of the last, decade or more. Because, I mean, they've brought him in Thunderbolts and all these other areas. And he's been the main villain here and the main villain there. And it's just like, I mean, I appreciate the fact that they're not making him an exclusive Spider-Man villain. But I'm not really appreciating the fact that he's actually in existence anymore.
Well, it's kind of interesting because they've gone out of their way, and even before he was taking part of that movies, when you talk about when they returned him, they kind of gone out of their way to make him the number three villain in the entire Marvel universe. You know, you would say, Magneto number one, Doctor Doom number two. They've gone out of the way to make him the number three villain of the entire Marvel universe, and unless you could consider someone like Galactus, I really don't personally. Yeah,
you know what he reminds me of now? He reminds me of Marvel's version of Lex Luthor.
Well, that is really it, and that's why when I say they've tried to make him kind of their number three villain, he that is what he is. That's the comparison, and. For that reason, no matter what they do with him, no matter how well they write him or the characterization, to me, he's always going to be a poor man's Lex Luthor. And even sometimes today's Lex Luthor is a poor man's Lex Luthor to me. So, I really don't think they ever should have brought him back, but that's an issue for another day when we'll get more into deaths and characters. So you're just, it's not like you hear Norman Osborn versus the Avengers and go, sweet, I'm on it.
Yeah, for me, I really, when I first saw him coming back, I cringed, and I think, the more that I hear his name in association with being a major villain for the Avengers and stuff like that, I am still cringing, and I still think that, you know, you could have done something, especially if you want a Lex Luthor character. Why did you need Norman Osborn? Could you not have just created someone else that fills that role that wouldn't make comic book fans our age
What if you had just taken a Justin Hammer or something like that and adjusted that character, you know, and switched him over to being more of the Lex Luthor character? Why not take an existing guy? I mean, there had to be somebody there, you know, or like you say, create a new character, or, you know, I don't know. Actually, let me ask you this. What offends you more now, or what offended you more at the time, bringing Norman Osborn back or Kraven the Hunter back?
Well, I guess in all fairness, they both really offend me.
I know, they really offend me too. That's the thing that they don't understand when they do these things. They don't understand that they're how many people they're actually offending, because if we've emotionally invested into the storyline and it meant something to us, we don't want that screwed with. And I'm going to say right now, I apologize for my foul mouth on the last show. I'm trying to keep it in line on this show. That said, I will fail. Just a warning.
Undoubtedly you will, yes. You have a history of failure. But
well, for instance, I'm your friend.
Yeah, that's right. And obviously I have a history of failure too.
All right. Let's not publicize that for the listening audience.
But I guess
actually quite popular.
One of the thing is, though, is that when I look at the deaths of the two of them, it's one thing the way Johnny Storm died in that issue of Fantastic Four, you know, to get dragged in by alien or denizens of the negative zone and kind of, you know, pushed away. So it's just like, you can assume he died, but you can also assume that he's still alive and being captured. But when you talk about both the death of Kraven and the death of the Green Goblin as they occurred, those were both really good deaths. Those were the kind of deaths that do mark, like, a turning point in the comic books.
Mm-hmm.
And so I really, because they were so good, I think that's what makes it harder for me to see them come back. When it's a wishy-washy, crappy death, then it's just like, oh, well, you know, that guy's coming back. Whatever. He didn't die very well anyways.
No. Well, I mean, it's one thing if you have the death of a character where you're going, like, I mean, when Superman died, Superman not even so much, because it was big enough and you were wondering, there was always a thought, they're probably going to bring him back. But at that time, the novelty of this entire thing hadn't weighed off or worn off quite to the same degree. So you had that idea of, well, maybe they won't bring him back. So there was always that little tinge there. But I mean, when Captain Marvel died, that's another one that meant something, right?
Absolutely.
When Captain America died, though, or Batman dies, or like we always, even Johnny Storm, I think the idea has always been, okay, it's part of a bigger storyline. They're dying in a storyline to be brought back in a storyline. It was never the idea of it was never meant to be permanent. And the fans knew that and accepted it. And that's why they weren't upset to see him come back. And it does, but they weren't trying to create that they were trying to create an interesting storyline, not an emotional investment like they did with Captain Marvel, Kraven, Norman Osborn. So it's a different idea.
One of the last things about Norman Osborn that I will say is the fact that I think maybe because it was so long, I feel like maybe they thought that a lot of the older fans maybe wouldn't mind, but that they were going to try to appeal to the newer fans who maybe didn't really realize how he died before. And so that was just like, hey, he's Norman Osborn. He's like a new villain now.
Yeah, but you know what? That's where they misunderstood, because even though it had been a long time, it's just the importance of that event and the amount that it was mentioned in subsequent issues and of course, Norman Osborn's son, Harry, you know, and that storyline. So it was always there. It was always present, even if you hadn't been around during that storyline. I wasn't reading Spider-Man when he was originally killed off. But it was always still meant something to me. It was so important to the Spider-Man mythos. Whereas Bucky, I didn't mind him being brought back because number one, it was well done. He wasn't quite the same, and it was so long. Who the hell had ever read Bucky?
You know? Yeah, I mean you had to read it very early. Bucky, yeah. Right?
Exactly. Or when Tim Drake was brought back, it again offended a lot of people, but it didn't offend me simply because I went, well, he's being brought back as a villain. That's always what his character really was always going to be anyways. Just saying, just pick up with Tim Drake. Yeah, so the Tim Drake character always looked like he was going to merge into being or become a villain or someday turn on the Batman character anyway. So the idea of him being brought back to life and doing that, I didn't feel like that character's storyline nearly was dead, and I didn't feel like it ruined the idea of the guilt that Batman was carrying. Like, I felt like that still was part of it, because now always Batman had guilt over his death, and now he still had guilt because now he's back and he's evil. So I didn't feel like it screwed with things too much, but I guess that's it. I mean, that's why it is difficult for the creators and the writers and to know what's going to strike a chord as being offensive to the readers and or not, because who knows why that isn't offensive to me and the other part is.
Yeah, because I'll admit too, even though they brought him back as a villain, that was a pretty offensive reach for me, you know, to bring him to Rick. Yeah. I mean, I read the stories and I thought that, I mean, the whole what the hell was he called again?
Red Hood.
Red Hood, yeah. The whole Red Hood storyline, it was pretty good. I was shocked because I expected to want to like burn each and every issue after I finished them, but I didn't. So no, I'll consider that a small victory.
That's true. I mean, you didn't. I think part of that was I really enjoyed that Black Mask character that was in the book there. It was written by Winnick. Of course, that particular character, now dead.
Yeah.
A different Black Mask, who I don't find nearly as interesting. So, I mean, whatever.
But one of the questions that I do have, especially as it pertains to Robin, is now that we're reaching into this, the new number ones and stuff like that, and the whole concept that the entire DC universe is only 4 to 5 years old.
5 years old.
Years old. I mean, and we've been through 3 Robins or 4 Robins.
Our future analyst, guest host, co-host, whatever he's going to be there, Cub Recorder K on Twitter, at Cub Recorder K.
Yep.
Keith wrote a fantastic, hilarious blog on why there's so many Robins and how it's just an internship position. And, you know, if you've had tragedy in your life, you can come in and, and you know, we bring whatever skills you are. If you've had some tragedy, whatever, that's, you know, you can apply for a position. You know.
Yeah, and I think that they appear to go through a lot, so there should be another opening soon.
There should be another opening soon. You see what they did with Tim? You know what offended me? It's funny, actually, you know, you talk about, I wasn't offended. It's a little things. Like, I'm not really offended when what's his name? I keep on calling him Tim Drake, and I think we're getting the name wrong. Who was it? Jason Todd.
Jason Todd, that's right.
Yeah, we'd be calling him Tim Drake the whole time. That's the other Robin.
Okay. Tim Drake, but he might as well have died.
Jason Todd. Yeah, Jason Todd, Red Hood number 2 and stuff. When suddenly they decided to, in the storyline where the Battle for the Cowl storyline, Jason Todd, all of a sudden was revealed that he's always had red hair. And he's not a brunette, he doesn't have black hair. He has red hair, and Batman always made him dye it in order to make it look like the other Robin.
That sounds creepy. Really, that sounds just more creepy.
And that's where I'm like offended. It's like he has red hair. That makes no sense. You can't just say it. Like he was dead, and he's come back from life, and he didn't have the red hair then.
Mm-hmm. Like, didn't we look at like see a panel or two of him climbing out of the Lazarus pit? Would not we have seen the red hair at that moment?
Like, you can't just do it, and even then it doesn't seem to have taken. But they decided we don't want him to look like all the other Robins. He's going to give him red hair and give his own personality. Can't just, you know what, it's...
I'm just waiting for the Robin, all Robin book, where it's just like every Robin that there's ever been teams up together to form some sort of a new Teen Titans, because they're... All teenagers now, aren't they?
Well, again, I think they said, what would be your future animal name? Again, Cub Recorder K, Keith, Twitter, plug him again because I really enjoyed it. And, you know, he said, what would be your future name? Blank Robin or Robin Blank? You know, and how many, or are you comfortable being Nightwing? No more than 3 allowed at a time.
Yeah.
Are you comfortable being Batman in the future? No limit number on how many Batmans there can be in the future, though. So, you know, anyways, maybe this is why the relaunch is good, because they have made a mess of this. If they can make a sense of all this, I mean, the continuity just over time, storylines start to run together, things don't start to make any sense from a point where it becomes a continuity mess. That's why they had to relaunch in
1985. Yes, I thought that was
what that did. Maybe when we look at it now that way now, we can go, Jesus Christ, it really is more of a mess than we realized.
Maybe what they need to do is just set an automatic relaunch date. Every 10, 20 years, they should just say, this is the date that we're going to relaunch every book, no matter what.
You know what? They could probably do it every 10 weeks. I think...
especially if Grant Morrison's writing, then we'll need to relaunch.
Jesus, you can do it every 10 panels then. But, you know, keep it makes sense for me. But, yeah, that's another thing, though. I mean, they have, you look at Superman. You know, John Byrne came on, Man of Steel, right, did this tremendous miniseries. Since then, there has been, before this relaunch, there's already been two rewrites. Geoff Johns did one, and I can't recall who did the other one. But there's... two or three, I think Loeb might have done one as well. So there's been two, three, four rewrites of his, of the continuity, already being retconned, as they say, for the Superman continuity and his origin story since 1985, two or three times. So what's the point of a relaunch? If you could just do it within existing continuity, why not just do it that way?
Well, I think part of it is because they spent so long doing the Infinite Crisis and the 52 and the Final Crisis and the Your Granny's Crisis and stuff like that. So I think what it comes down to is that they're involving the entire universe so much that if you just retcon a Superman, well, then Superman's different, but Batman isn't different. You know, you can't fix the Robin problem right now.
No. I don't know. Maybe we can't fix the Robin problem right now.
I could fix the Robin problem.
With a baseball bat.
Yeah.
Yeah. By the way, the sales on Granny's Crisis, a little disappointing. So
I'm shocked. It's too bad. Because they had a great writer on that one, too.
All right. Well, okay. You want me to hit another topic here? I can easily find another one.
Fair enough. You know, there was another topic that you had mentioned at one point, which I thought would be kind of interesting to touch on. As we talk about Robin, and you had brought up the idea of who is the hardest character to write in comics,
we should get into this. The hardest characters to write, or character or characters to write, and the easiest to write as well. You know, and that's a long-term discussion we'll probably get into here, and one where in the future I'd like to get other people's viewpoints on it, because I think it's interesting. Fascinating how to break that down. But why don't we start on that? Why don't you you have some things to say?
Well, you know, one of the guys that I was thinking of is actually Aquaman.
I never thought about that.
Because I think one of the most interesting elements of your idea is the fact, how do you go into a book when there's already been so many titles that have come before, and you basically know that you're going to be doomed to fail? Because as a character... Aquaman sucks.
Well, Aquaman or Submariner?
Well, they're basically the same thing. I mean, Submariner is maybe slightly more interesting on the food chain, but only slightly. If, you know, because I don't really know. I mean, they're both kind of sucky. I think when you write their titles, the one thing that you have to do is make sure that if there is one of the opposite characters going on, then you have to be sure that you're not writing the same stories.
It's funny because both of them are really important to the universe, and yet both of them cannot sustain a book that I would be interested or here's anybody would be interested in reading. And yet you can't go, oh, just take him out of there. Just don't use Aquaman anymore. He's too important.
Mm-hmm.
Same with Namor. He's too important. But that doesn't mean you can build something around him. They're important for other factors. Do you ever see the Aquaman pilot, like the teen hero Aquaman?
Yes,
show,
I did.
The Smallville version.
I didn't mind it.
I enjoyed. That's probably the best Aquaman I've ever seen.
Yeah, and it's funny because I happened to see it. I was able to see it when I was in Las Vegas. We went to one of these TV tryout things where they actually sit you down at the little video screen, and you're able to sit and watch the show, and then you kind of run through and rate it. And so I remember, like, I was watching it, and I thought, Aquaman, this is awesome! I get to watch Aquaman! And then, you know, I'm watching it through, and I'm like, you know, I mean, obviously it's not sweet, it's not wicked, but it wasn't too bad. Yeah, because it was really a Smallville version.
Yeah, exactly. I don't really see any difference in quality between that and Smallville and so much, you know, and it probably can... probably something I thought could have grown, but you talk about, he is definitely very difficult to write, and one of the things that's difficult about a character like Aquaman is, I actually think Aquaman's kind of interesting, I actually think Namor's kind of interesting, but I don't think they have any interesting characters around them.
Yeah.
And if you don't have any interesting supporting players at all, you're screwed. Now, they put some good writers on both characters, and even they were not able to do so much so good, and often do something really wacky, like, you know, have piranhas eat off their hand.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, give them a hook. That'll do it. That's a hook for you.
That's a hook. Yeah, exactly. So you kind of, holy, yeah. I almost said the S word there, but I didn't. I didn't say shit. Thank God.
But, you know, another thing about Aquaman is that Aquaman gets the big old no respect outside of comic books as well. Like, you look at a show like Robot Chicken, and they got their little Justice League thing, or like, you know, Justice League Big Brother that has the Hulk in it. And it's just like, Aquaman's in there, and it's just like, why don't you go get me a sandwich, Aquaman? I'm busy, you know? Go do this, Aquaman.
Well, even then, if you say to people, what are Aquaman's powers? Well, he can swim fast, and he can breathe underwater, and he can talk to fish.
Yes!
Everyone, sweet, that's all I always wanted to be. No, what you wanted to be was a dude who can jump 50 feet in the air and climb walls and have super strength and beat the hell out of people or fly or have all these cool gadgets. He doesn't have that. That's another problem with Aquaman. I definitely think Aquaman's on that list, definitely of hardest characters to write. That said, I have to admit, I've always had one storyline for Aquaman that I always thought would blow people's minds.
Ooh, me too,
the
me too.
Is, well, yeah, exactly. Like, I have one Aquaman storyline. I have one Namor storyline.
Mine is Aquaman, fish psychologist. He gets to talk to the fish, and he gets to help them through their problems. See, that is totally an Aquaman storyline.
Mine's a little different.
Really?
I wish I had written yours, though. I you know what? You gave it away on the air. Now,
that's because I actually want somebody to write that story. If somebody writes that story, I will be so happy.
That'd be awesome. No, but I do have one good idea. I have one, and that's it. At least I can come up with something, but it's difficult to sustain it. And I do think one of the things I think makes a character difficult to write is people can, you can come up with a 2 to 4 issue arc maybe, or 1 issue, but can you come up with something that you can sustain for 2 years? Can you come up with 24 or 25 issues of something and make it interesting? And that's where characters like Aquaman become very difficult. And also, I think anytime you have a character which is really, really difficult for both the writer and the fan base to relate with, that's it. What do you relate with about Namor? Or, like, Spider-Man is very relatable.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you know? Absolutely.
And that's a big part of his key. Mr. Fantastic is the least popular member of the Fantastic Four because he's the least relatable.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
I mean, you know, as far as Aquaman goes, I can talk to fishes too. It doesn't mean that they listen to me.
No, no, they might.
Okay.
I mean, I don't know. The fishes might be listening to you. Here's the problem with talking to fish. Even if they are listening to you, their brains are like the size of an ant. It's so tiny. It's you can barely even see it. You know, another difficult character, like I say, anytime you have that unrelatable character, Wonder Woman. Again, same idea. How does anybody relate to Wonder Woman?
Or make her interesting for the most part. It's just a struggle.
How? Because she's really difficult to write. Superman is difficult to write in some ways. Like, because some writers and some people I know will never relate to a guy that can do everything. So, I mean, that's what was interesting. That's what Byrne said was, no, this guy's Clark Kent. Superman is who he portrays, but he's the person of Clark Kent. And that's what makes me wonder about the relaunch, because the relaunch, it's, no, this guy's an alien, an outsider. He is Superman. Clark Kent's who he portrays. And I think that takes away the ability of people to resonate with that character and to bond with him.
Well, and I think another thing that that with the Byrne storyline, with that one, is he kind of said, well, okay, if Superman's not that interesting, the supporting cast is going to be really interesting.
Really interesting. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And that's something, like I say, that you can't really do that with Wonder Woman even again. Like,
no, your supporting cast is up and down.
Yeah. So it really does become, I think anytime you have a team dynamic, that can be difficult to write. But if it's a team like Avengers where you can bring in different people and have your own vision, that's one thing. If it's a team like Fantastic Four is kind of already set, that's difficult. Anytime you're writing a character who is way smarter than you are, I mean, Reed Richards is so much smarter than me. How do I fake having a character that smart? You know what I mean? The character's so smart. How do you fake that or make him relatable? Like, all these little things that make a character really, really difficult to write.
Mm-hmm. I think that when you, I mean, one of the number one things, and you did mention it, is that whole idea of the supporting cast. And as we've seen, supporting cast makes a character. When you have that great supporting cast, it's suddenly, even if you have to drop your lead character into a somewhat supporting status, then you can do that. But when you don't have that supporting cast like Aquaman, then, you know, your lead character has to try to carry that book.
Yeah, exactly. Or even, let's just look at the most interesting characters. Let's just take Fantastic Four, the original Fantastic Four. Okay? Who's the most interesting character? Most relatable, most likable, best character?
Well, I would have to say, I mean, for me, actually, I think it would be Sue.
Okay. And number two?
After that, it's probably Ben.
And then Johnny Storm?
Johnny Storm, and then Reed and Richards, then yeah.
Fantastic, yeah. For me, it would go Ben Grimm, the Thing, and then I would go Johnny Storm, and then Sue, and then Richards. So the idea, though, being that the drop-off from that first character and how much you like him to that fourth character is really, really high.
Mm-hmm.
That's another thing, you know? I mean, if you're reading the book, it's like anytime they're focusing on Reed Richards, am I going to be bored waiting for them to focus on one of the other guys? You know, like,
I actually have less problem following Dr. Doom. Like, I think he's a more relatable character than Reed Richards.
Oh, I think so too. I think so too. And I think that's always been an issue. Like I said, but I think that's an issue anytime people are writing somebody who's so much smarter than the author, and then so much smarter than the audience. That's the thing. Peter Parker was a really bright guy. I mean, Peter Parker was in school, scientifically gifted, right?
Mm-hmm.
But he was still a normal guy. Like, he was, I don't, maybe he was a genius, maybe not. I never really thought of it one way or another, you know. I mean, obviously he invented his web shooters and such, and especially early on in the series, a lot more of his intelligence was played up. But that, because that was a part of his, people don't mind if he's smart, but as long as he's still relatable. Like I say, that's where you can't, I mean, nobody's going to question that Bruce Wayne is smart, but Bruce Wayne is relatable because he's still extremely flawed.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So, I mean, that's part of the thing that I think has to make the character work.
No, you're absolutely right.
Okay, so let's, who else do you think is really, really difficult to write? Anybody else who's on your list there?
I think when it comes down to it, I think that I always come back to the fact that the characters are pretty much destined to die. It's hard to write that character. Like, how do you write Huntress? Because you know that the series is only going to last like 12 issues.
Yeah, oh yeah. Yeah, I mean, some characters, it's you know, you can make Iron Fist as good as you want, but odds are, in the end of the day, it's not going to run for 500 issues. That said, I mean, if Thor wasn't member of the Fantastic Four and was just, or not Fantastic, I mean, Avengers and didn't have the movie and such, I mean, Thor, his sales at times have been tanked, and his sales, You know, it's because he's been around for so long that they've kept the series going at time.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been a good thing, right? He's a hard to relate to character.
Another one is Doctor Strange.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you can, and it's another thing with Doctor Strange, too, and I think this is kind of what Thor falls into, is that concept of, you can try to write them, but you have to write them with that language. You know, Doctor Strange and his, by the all-seeing eye of Agamotto, I cast you into the depths. And it's just like, who wants to write that? Who wants to read that? Like, you know, Steve Ditko and Stan Lee did that years ago, and it was fine.
It was
back
the
then. 60s. But,
it was the 60s.
But nowadays, I mean, you got Joe Straczynski, and he's writing a 5 or 6 issue, like, new Doctor Strange, which is, I mean, the same damn origin as before, just slightly updated, and it's just like, I still struggle to care.
You know, that's one of the things I actually think that the Ultimate Universe take on Thor works so much better. They got rid of that bullshit. And it really, you know, I mean, he was much more relatable, and his dialogue wasn't tempered with that heavy edge, you know. Mm-hmm. He's a much more contemporary character, so I mean that's good. Now, Captain America has been a character people have found difficult to write over the years.
Not Mark Gruenwald, though. When you can pop up a story like Cap Wolf, then how can that be hard to write?
Well, that's exactly it. If you're okay writing absolute crap, then. You know, but I mean, he's a character. They've done a good job in the last few years of making more relatable for people than he really was. I think he was a character who was distant for a while. And I think that's what we're seeing a lot of when we talk about it. There's a lot of distance between the character and the core fan base. I mean, that's where it becomes difficult. My all-time favorite character, Captain Marvel, of Power of Shazam. My favorite character, my favorite book, my favorite everything. But like you say, how do you write it when you know it's going to go 12 issues? Like, they can't sustain that character. That's a character I don't know why, because it should relate to the idea of, a 14-year-old boy or whatever actually getting the powers and going to do whatever he wants. It's like every boy's dream, which is why, you know, when he first debuted, he was outselling Superman. But maybe the concept is just dated. Maybe it doesn't matter so much anymore.
Well, and is it just that the concept is really hard to continue? Like that whole 14-year-old boy kid in a candy store thing. It's the same. I like to view it as the same idea of when I was a kid and the idea of living in a mall. You know, and it's just like, oh, I would love to live in a mall. But then you kind of see that in a movie or something, and you realize after an hour and a half, and it's just like, okay, I don't really need to see that again. I'm done with that concept. And so is that the same thing with Power of Shazam and Billy Batson? Is it like, you know, you write a few issues of that and it's kind of like, I don't actually know where to go with a 14-year-old boy anymore.
Yeah, I think there's something to be said for that. I think there's also something to be said for a character like that. You don't want to jettison his past and his rich history and everything. But on the other hand, you don't want to keep having him say,
Holy moly?
Holy moly.
And golly gee and all that stuff.
Golly gee and being called the big red cheese, because he's a parody of himself then, and nobody can relate to that either. So, I mean, Jeff Smith's miniseries was brilliant. It proves how great that character can be. But that's exactly it. That was the strength of it. It was a miniseries.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
And a lot of these characters, I mean, I like the fact that they carry characters on in miniseries most of the time. Don't give me a character in their own regular series. Give me a miniseries. I would happily read a really strong miniseries every couple of years from an average character than a series that's only going to last a year and a half, that's really like, you got a strong intro because that's the opening miniseries, and then you got a whole bunch of shit afterwards.
Yeah, and also, you know what, you see a lot of characters who the publishers think to themselves, that's a character that should have a series when it isn't. Like, Green Arrow should be a miniseries. And then when another good idea for miniseries comes out, they should do another one. Continuing story, if it's not, since Grell, you know, who really has cared? And essentially, he was a 75-issue miniseries.
Yeah, I mean, so, I mean,
maxi series, right?
Chuck Dixon lasted a long time on the next one, which is kind of surprising, but
yeah, he lasted a long time. But were you reading it?
No.
That's my point.
I love the character, but I've known a lot of the Chuck Dixon.
Chuck Dixon is the, when you talk about how do you write a book that you know is going to be canceled, Chuck Dixon is the exception to the rule. He'll just start writing and not care. He just, it's just one of 4,000 books he was writing that month at that time. You
well,
know?
I actually think that Chuck Dixon's one of those writers that you put him on a book when you kind of need it to carry on. So you need consistent storytelling that's yeah. not going to be like that's not going to kill the book, but you get consistent storytelling that somebody out there is bound to keep buying it. You know, it's not going to piss off your fan base, but it's not going to gain yeah. the new readers.
No, no. Of course, then shortly after they killed off the actual Green Arrow, so. But they brought him back.
Yeah.
Again, we're going to go into this death thing at some point. We're going to have to. So what about easiest characters to write?
Easiest characters. Well,
actually, you know what? Before we go on to that, I just want to say, I think Spider-Man has become increasingly difficult. I think Spider-Man 20 years ago wasn't that difficult a character to write because he was always down on his luck, but he was an optimist. And people could relate to a person who's always down on his luck, but is an optimist and is trying his best. And over the years, I kind of feel like the optimism and his carefree attitude has been chipped away at. And now when they try and put it in there, it feels more forced. And I think the character is kind of has become more difficult to write as time has gone on.
Well, I think they've just started overburdening it.
And his supporting cast has changed. His supporting cast also has not been as strong for many years,
mm-hmm.
In my opinion. So,
but they just keep loading him up with crap, and I think that it just keeps, you know, eventually there's only so much crap that you can load up, you know, and then you bring in the concept of, yes, he's got a wife, which people hate him having, you know, half the people love Aunt May, half the people hate Aunt May, half the people want to bring Uncle Ben back, half the people want to bring his parents back, you know, and it's just like, you know, too much.
And you know what, maybe, yeah, I mean, that's it. I mean, I liked him married, but I hated Aunt May.
Yeah.
So, I mean, but you might be the opposite, you know? So, I mean, how do you please all that? Maybe you just need all those different universes and take on him for that reason. But,
well, yeah, because it's hard.
He's way harder. He's way hard. He's extremely difficult to write now, I think. One of the most.
But no, absolutely. Like, when he first came out, I think that, you know, you could easily, and before he was married, you really knew that all he had was a girlfriend to take care of in Mary Jane or Gwen Stacy. And then
he was always screwing up with them.
Yeah, and then he had Aunt May, who he had to try to, like, buy her drugs.
Yeah, he had to try and pay Aunt May's bills, keep the girlfriend happy.
And not piss off JJJ, yeah.
Not piss off JJJ, and meanwhile try and save the world.
Yeah.
And he was always losing out on one or two of these things, and you always felt for him, but he always had that optimism. So yeah, somehow that's just, it's changed. And he's become a different character to write and a more difficult character. So, I mean, anybody can come up with a storyline around what we've just talked about because almost everybody can relate to it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, who didn't have a life similar to that when they were 20 years old, you know?
Okay, for me, I think that when I look at one of the easier characters, I mean, again, another big character, it's Batman.
Definitely.
Because I think it seems that there's no shortage of storylines that you can do, and you can actually do a fair chunk of things. Like, you can really do some, you can go different places with Batman, and I think that people are still going to be pretty forgiving about that.
Well, absolutely. I think one of the strengths of Batman is you could do a detective story, you could do a horror story, you could do a super spy story, you can do a superhero story, you can do all of these things. You can do a martial arts story, and nobody's offended by it because they all fit within that Batman character and Batman universe. You cannot do a spy story with Peter Parker. It just doesn't fly. You know, you haven't got that same. And the other thing was, I don't know if it's easy to write a great Batman story, but it is easy to come up with good Batman stories. There's so his rogues gallery, and that is one thing Spider-Man mm-hmm. does have, though they've weakened that as well. They've weakened that over the years as well. But the, I mean, he did have the second best rogues gallery Spider-Man did behind Batman. But Batman's rogues gallery is so amazing that there's just so much you can do with that.
Yeah. And, you know, when you, when you've got a character that is kind of a one-size-fits-all, he's like a skeleton key. You can fit him, you can fit him into any lock, and he's going to open that door. I mean, his time with Justice League, his time on his own, he's got Robin, he's got the great rogues gallery. I mean, just fantastic.
Exactly, exactly. He's like, he's like a piece of clay.
Yeah.
You mold him however you want.
Clay face.
So, yeah, no, exactly.
A piece of clay face.
Exactly. He's a piece of clay face, kind of like you. You're welcome.
You can mold me however you like.
I'm not touching you, asshole. But
good. That wasn't an invitation.
Thank God. But yeah, I mean, I think he is the easiest to write. It's really, there's nobody else on his level. Who else is easy to write? I mean, a lot of characters I don't think are overly difficult. I think anytime you get a space character again, I think that can be difficult.
Except,
you know, Silver Surfer and stuff like that.
But like, say a Green Lantern, I wouldn't put as hard to write per se, because I think that he's one of those characters that you can do space epic, but you can also do down home epic.
I think Wolverine's actually a very easy character to write, because I think he's much the same as Batman, and that you can do a noir story with Wolverine and it'll fit. You could do a martial arts or a romance story. You can all make that fit within that character. So I think he's one of the easier ones to write. But again, there's a difference between being able to write it and being able to do a great one, right?
Mm-hmm.
But just to be able to come up with concepts for Wolverine, I don't think is that difficult.
No, no. And, I mean, again, you can fit him anywhere. I mean, he fits into a team book. He fits into, you know, his own book. He's part of S.H.I.E.L.D. He's part of the Avengers. He's part of the X-Men. He's on his own. He's got the Japanese backstory.
Yeah. Now, what do you consider about the Hulk? Would he be an easy or hard character to write?
Well, I mean, I think it's so hard because I think that he's actually had really that, like, relatively few writers overall. But I think that he's probably, I would probably put him in the easier category to write, because you can either make him stupid Hulk or you can make him smart Hulk.
Yeah, I think that's one advantage you have. I think, or you can just do a lot of action stories around him. I think you can come up with concepts for Hulk pretty easily, but I think it's difficult to break new ground with him.
Yeah,
absolutely.
I think
it's easy. That's the thing. It's easy to be able to tell enjoyable stories. It's not so easy to break new ground with the Hulk. And you know what? When you get to the team books, Avengers and JLA, I think they're both extremely easy to write. You know, especially Avengers, I think, because I think they have more interesting villains.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
So, and they have Ultron. Who rules?
Ultron does rule. And I mean, you know, Ultron, the great thing about Ultron is he's like that gift that keeps on giving, because you can pretty much bring him in at any time.
Yes.
It's like, oh, this guy here, he's Ultron.
And I do think that's one advantage Marvel has over DC, is Marvel has more villains that you can bring in, and they're just cool, and you can bring them in at any time, and they can work with just about any character and any dynamic. You know, I think they have more guys like that. Whereas,
yeah, they do seem to have a ton of characters that are really, like, large in scope.
Yeah, yeah, I think they have a lot more villains like that. So I think that's one advantage they have. So, any other characters you think are easy to write? Anybody else in your mind?
Not really. You know, I'm not really coming up. I mean, I thought of another harder character in the Punisher. Because so few people, I mean, he's lasted for a while, but I think so few people have been able to really do him right. Because otherwise, he's just a guy who goes out and shoots bad guys, which can make him easy to write. You know, you write a bunch of mob stories and Punisher kills them, and it's just like, hey, that's an easy book.
Is it kind of along that same idea as the Hulk, in that it's not so hard to write, but it's hard to break new ground?
Yeah.
I think the character, the problem with the Punisher is, of all the characters that have had so many issues published on them as a lead character, solo character, his character development might be the shallowest of any character ever. which in some people would argue is his strength, maybe, you know, because I mean, he is just that, for lack of better term, spirit of vengeance, you know, yeah. Or revenge, maybe, spirit of revenge. That's all he is, you know. But for that reason, I think there's a lot more that can be done with him. It's just nobody's done it yet.
Yeah, I mean, you know, props to Garth Ennis because his Punisher run is fantastic, and he really did take a good.
But it's polarizing, though.
Oh, absolutely, it is.
I mean, you say it's fantastic. I know other people that don't think so. It's a polarizing run.
I mean, it's not an easy run. Like, I mean, he's a hard writer. I mean, he's one of those guys that I mean, you know, the Punisher is a dirtbag kind of thing.
His Punisher is a really unlikable guy, and that makes it difficult.
I think for me, because I didn't like the Punisher before, you know, it was just like I'd rather read anything than the Punisher. And so when you kind of look at this Punisher character, and it's just like he's as I expect that he should be.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Now the Punisher movies, in the second movie, I think was way better than the first one. I did not like the first one. In that second movie, he was just that. He was that Garth Ennis dirtbag character. And there was really nothing redeemable about him. And I enjoyed the second one a lot more than the first one. So, I mean...
That's interesting, yeah. Because, I mean, at the same time, I just thought that the movie itself was so awful. That
really?
The character, like, maybe I would have preferred the character, but I just couldn't, I thought that the direction was so bad, the writing was so bad, the acting was so bad, that by the end of it, I would rather go back and watch Dolph Lundgren as the Punisher than watch the third, or watch the Punisher Warzone movie.
Really? And I really enjoyed the Punisher Warzone movie, whereas the first Punisher with, Thomas Jane, I did not like at all, and
it had its issues, no question.
I it's been too long since I've seen the Dolph Lundgren, though. Probably the best. He's probably the physically the best portrayal of what Punisher should look like. But all right, let's move on to another subject here. Unless there's anything else you want to say on that.
No, I think that that covers me off. I got my rant on Aquaman.
Okay, let's talk about something, because we talked a little bit about Marvel's animation in the recent episode. Now, they have anime movies coming out. They had an anime Wolverine. There's an anime Iron Man, which just dropped, as the kids say. So, I mean, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, they've been around for a while, and I know that Warren Ellis has actually written most of them. And obviously, I have a great affinity for his work, but I believe that that a lot of people look forward to those stories. I think that they're fairly well done, and maybe it's an area that they can kind of branch out in and succeed, where DC's not really trying to make a push.
It's a different type of animation that DC isn't trying to make a push in. And when we're sitting there and we're a little hard on the Marvel animated universe or projects, maybe it's that. These are so under the radar, and we're not even discussing them, talking about them, and the fact there is good quality there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there is probably better. I mean, Marvel has made good animated pictures. I mean, the Hulk versus Thor, the Hulk versus Wolverine, those were both good stories, and exactly what you'd expect. I just don't think that they were as, you know, probably as fulfilling as most of DC's movies.
Okay, and let's see here. Another subject I wanted to talk about is there's a Magneto miniseries just about to drop, and I want to know your thoughts on villains getting either miniseries or even regular series.
Well, I'm actually a fan of it, because as long as they write them the way that they should be written, like as long as they maintain them as a villain in the piece. You know, I kind of go back to Doom 2099, mm-hmm. because I look at that, and you take this character who they portray, like he was a hero in parentheses, but there's no question about the fact that he still had his like villain tendencies. He still basically wanted to rule the world at the end of the day. Mm-hmm. My biggest problem is when they take a villain and they try to make them you know, so relatable that they wind up almost making them a good guy during this miniseries. And then at the end of it, you go back and read them in a regular series, and they're still a dirtbag villain.
Yeah, you know what? I can Deathstroke. Because I mean, they turned Deathstroke was a villain in Teen Titans, and then he had his own series and really did become a hero. You know, and then they turned him back into being a real hardcore villain. And the thing is, his series was really good, his solo series. I mean, I enjoyed it quite a bit, written by Marv Wolfman, of course, who nobody knows the character better, right?
And it did give us Chain Gang War.
Yeah, which I enjoyed.
Mm-hmm.
Some people do not, but I love Chain Gang War.
That's right.
But that's a character that was changed in order to have his own series. You look back on the Joker. The Joker in the 70s had his own comic book series. I think it lasted like 13 episodes or issues or mm-hmm. 19 or 11. Like, it wasn't many.
No, it wasn't.
And basically, because he's basically what it meant was it wasn't really even focused on him. It was still focused on the Batman. It's just now the Batman was never going to fight anybody else but the Joker. Like, it was only the Joker was basically the only enemy of the Batman in this. And so that doesn't really work. I like the idea of villains in I don't like the idea of ongoing series, but yeah, I think if you do it in a miniseries, it's a good way to flesh out a character.
Yeah, a miniseries is the perfect way to go.
Okay, and one last subject that I have for the day, I just want to talk about a little bit, because we talk about the superhero summer here, this 2011. I'm going to read some stats to you here. And
hit me.
To kind of get your thoughts on this. These are all Thor. I'm going to open with that one. Okay? Production budget of Thor was $150 million. Its domestic gross is $189.55. And I'm just going to read these out, and you can jump in at any point if there's anything that you think is interesting. But it's a $180 gross, $150. X-Men First Class was $160. So it was a $10 million more budget. And gross $35 million less, $135. So it's gross $145 domestically, cost $160. So it's actually on the domestic side here a money loser, which I don't think a lot of people realize because it did $145 million.
Well, and I think but one of the really interesting things about that is that, I mean, Thor hasn't even reached DVD yet.
No.
You know, I don't know when Thor is due out. But X-Men First Class, on the other hand, which was released after it, is slated out, whatever, it's like next month on DVD or something like that. So it's coming up really fast.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's almost like that's because they lost a little bit or because they didn't make up as much money as they were hoping. They're pushing it out to DVD sooner so that they can try to make up that ground.
Yeah, that could be. Now, I'm going to get to international gross in a moment here, but I'm just going to finish off here. So you had Captain America. And Captain America was $140 million budget. So that's 10 less than Thor and 20 less than X-Men First Class. And it's grossed $156 million. So it's $156 million so far on $140 million budget. So it's already past X-Men First Class and it's sneaking up on Thor. So it's a moneymaker. It looks like of the three, Captain America will make the most money. Thor number two. And X-Men First Class number three. So your thoughts on that?
Well, I definitely think that in the case of Captain America and Thor, it's because part of it's because they're Avengers tie-ins. But I also think that, in my opinion, both are really strong movies.
What about X-Men First Class? I mean, it's also generally well-received. It's part of an existing franchise. When you say that those other two are the Avengers movies, is X-Men First Class hurt by the fact that the third X-Men movie blew donkey balls?
You know, it probably is. And I think another problem is that it's taking away from the fans element. Because when you look at when you look at Captain America, you know, you look at the origin story in there, and there's not a lot of tinkering. I mean, they've tinkered a bit, but it's basically straight out of the comics. But when you look at X-Men First Class and they're just basically saying, you know, we're calling it X-Men First Class, because we like the title. But we're going out on our own here. This has nothing to do with the comics.
Yeah, there was an X-Men First Class. No, there was an X-Men First Class miniseries, but this is, even it's different than this.
They don't share anything other than the name.
Yeah, exactly. Now, while we're talking about this, we've talked about how Green Lantern is the greatest disappointment. So I'm going to just read this out to you. Green Lantern gross right now is at 114. Captain America, 156. X-Men, 145. Thor, 180. So we're looking at $30 million less for Green Lantern than X-Men. So, I mean, X-Men is considered a successful movie, and Green Lantern is considered a failure, even though it grossed 114. But the difference is the $200 million budget, mm-hmm. first off. So that means it's more expensive than X-Men First Class by $40 million. So you look at the difference, and we're talking $70 million. You know, the $40 million more to produce, $30 million less to brought in.
It also makes a difference, too, because like you say, X-Men First Class was fairly well received, whereas Green Lantern was not.
I'm going to get to the international worldwide summary, though, because I think this is even more, to some degree, even more interesting. Thor is at worldwide $267 million. X-Men First Class at $204. Captain America at $128. So, I mean, Captain America not nearly as far as strong. But so let's look at that, though. I mean, Thor, 267, the next highest, X-Men First Class at 204. It vastly outproduced worldwide and international gross, foreign gross, vastly outproduced X-Men First Class. What do you think of that?
Well, I think that Thor really has a wide base. And I know that there was a lot of people, because Thor was actually released worldwide before it was released in the U.S. And so I think that a lot of it actually comes down to Kenneth Branagh and his fan base, which I think many of is kind of outside of the U.S. And I think because it's a, I'll say Norse storyline, though it really doesn't hinge on that too much. But I think that those kind of things make it a little more interesting to those outside and in the European Union and such. Whereas, obviously, Captain America, a little more America-centric.
Okay. Let's talk about, then, Captain America. You say a little more American-centric. We talked about how it's at 156, Thor's at 180. That's the domestic gross. So basically what we're looking at 156 is Captain America is probably going to surpass Thor. But yes, worldwide, whereas foreign gross, like I say, 267 for Thor, 128 for Captain America. So that probably is really highlights what you mentioned there.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're going to get to the really disappointing one. I talked about Green Lantern, how he's losing $70 million in the hole to X-Men First Class. This is where they really fall off, though, and this is a surprise to me. Only $61 million worldwide.
Wow.
114 domestic, and that to me, when I saw that number, only 35% of its only 35% of it is a domestic gross. So, I mean, it's a foreign gross, 35%. But so that's really terrible.
I just think with the Green Lantern, it comes down to it being such a poorly reviewed movie, and I just don't really think that it captured people's imaginations as it really should have. I think it struggled because there was so much CG in it. Mm-hmm. And I think that when you look at the characters, like Batman has worked because he's still Batman, you know, and I think that Captain America works because he's human. And even all the CG in Thor, they still made the character human in that regard. And I think that were really, like, all the space elements and the like from Green Lantern. I don't know, but people just really didn't go for it.
I actually would have thought the space elements and the Green Lantern elements would have played in the foreign markets, and obviously it didn't. Like I say, even Captain America, which is the word America
mm-hmm.
in the title.
Firmly planted.
Is, yeah, exactly. So easily, like I say, easily worldwide is Thor. So far in the summer, if you combine them both, Thor's at $448 million. Number two would be X-Men First Class at $349 million. And Captain America, $285 million. So Captain America probably, I think, worldwide, looks like it'll probably finish pretty close to X-Men First Class, about that $350 million range. And Thor, about $450 million. So Thor is easily the big hit of the summer. And then Green Lantern looks like it'll maybe hit $180 million. So it'll be almost 50% of what X-Men First Class and Captain America were by the time it's all said and done. Let's just say $61 million only worldwide international gross for Green Lantern. I'd like to thank Box Office Mojo for this, I should mention, because this is where I'm getting these stats from. And another comic book property, Priest, $47 million, and that's a much smaller movie, much smaller, absolutely. $47 million foreign gross, so almost catching up. Just one other comic book property that a lot of people may not realize: Cowboys and Aliens, $88 million worldwide, $81 million domestic, only $7 million international, and certainly with the two lead stars, Daniel Craig and Harrison Ford, I found that.
Well,
really
and what was the budget?
That budget on that one's $160 million as well, so yeah. A very expensive film. So.
And it's interesting because one thing that movie
technically has... $163 million, so technically wow. The second most expensive movie behind Green Lantern.
Yeah, and one thing that movie's done is because they were creating a Johnny Depp Lone Ranger movie, and they've actually decided to pull the plug on that.
Really?
Because of that exact fact. One of the, like, reason one was because Westerns don't play, and Cowboys and Aliens is the, like, the big loser. And so, yeah. Because of that. And then also the word is that Gore Verbinski wouldn't budge on his budget. He wanted an inordinately high budget for the Lone Ranger. And my number one question for that is, how big a budget do you need for a Western?
That's absolutely true. But I'll say this. I'll just go back and watch Antonio Banderas. Was it Mask of Zorro or Legend of Zorro? Which one was the first one?
I
think it was Mask, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
And that was tremendous. And you're not going to do a better Zorro movie than that one. So just go back and watch that one. That was a really, really good, fun summer blockbuster action movie.
Mm-hmm.
Represents the character, but also...
But this is the Lone Ranger movie that we're talking about.
Oh, Lone Ranger. Oh, what'd I say?
Zorro.
I thought you said Zorro. My mistake. Well, last time we did a Lone Ranger movie, I think, was in the early 80s somewhere. And, yeah, that was not... actually, you know what? I'm just going to quickly on Box Office Mojo look it up here, because we have the technology. We can build it. What is it?
Bail count?
Faster.
Bigger.
Stronger.
Yeah. It doesn't really matter.
Well... Yeah,
I think ultimately the key thing is that, you know, part of the reason that the Lone Ranger got shut down is because of fallout from Cowboys and Aliens.
Okay, Legend of the Lone Ranger, which was released in 1981 and grossed $12 million at the time, and pretty average movie from all I can see. I don't even think it had a star of note. But yeah, I mean nobody's. I mean, I love westerns, but nobody's
Nobody
else
does.
Them, and even, like I said, yeah, exactly. Nobody's looking for them, and even big concept westerns, that's not where you should be making your westerns.
No.
Small concept westerns, good stories, that's where they should be going.
So. Yeah, I think that you can make your money on westerns, but you need to tell a good story. I don't think you need to pour money into them like it's going out of style.
And to steal Addy's line from We Talk Rusty McGhost on that one, quite frankly, Johnny Depp's... his star meter is not high enough that he can bring in people just to come watch and be the Lone Ranger, guaranteed box office. I mean, that's not the case. So.
No.
Any last things you want to say before we get out in this show?
No, I think that the number one thing, I just want to see some emails, see if we can drum up some interest and some more stuff. So, you know, come visit us. We're on Podomatic. We talk comics at Podomatic. weetalkpodcast.com, I believe it is. We're going to be up, we're going to be getting weetalkpodcast.com going really soon. You can still email us. You can email comics@weetalkpodcast.com. You can email mo@weetalkpodcast.com, and you can email brett@weetalkpodcast.com. You know, if you've got something that you want us to talk about and maybe give our opinions on, then feel free to send that across, and we'll have a look, and we'll probably even fit it onto to an upcoming show.
Yeah, we should have an interview with Adrian Barbeau coming on soon, and Brett's Brett_WeTalk on Twitter. I'm Mo_WeTalk, and yeah, I mean, I think that's it. I think this is where don't we usually go out here with what you usually call one of my lame jokes? I usually tell a lame joke to leave the show.
You always tell a lame joke. Every one of your jokes is lame.
O-U-T.
What? No, let's bounce tonight?
Good night, folks.
Good night.